My name is Dan Schaefer. Thank you for joining us. For the last 6 years, the Democratic Party of Wisconsin has been run by Ben Wickler. In that time, as chair of the party, Democrats and Democratic-aligned candidates have won 7 of 10 statewide races, including flipping the balance of power on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. But in April, after yet another win in a pivotal Wisconsin Supreme Court race, Wickler announced he'd be stepping down as chair. The party will be electing its next chair in less than a month at their upcoming convention on June 14th and 15th in Wisconsin Dells. Here to join us today to talk about this transition and so much more is Ben Wickler, the now outgoing chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Ben, thank you so much for being here. Thanks for joining us.
Dan, thanks for having me on. And thanks for all your great coverage at the Recombobulation Area and here at Civic Media.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you so much. So have you had a little bit of time to recombobulate yourself since the announcement a little over a month ago here?
Let's say a mid-recombobulation at this point.
Only some mild recombobulating happening.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've got a lot to get to.
The process has begun. You know?
Yes, the recombobulation process has begun. Glad to hear it. Well, you've certainly earned it after this run as WISDEM's chair.
I will say that today feels like an auspicious day to join you because today, this week, Elon Musk has announced that he's going to stop spending so much money in politics. And it's widely reported that this is because of the blowout where he fell on his face in Wisconsin. And so that feels very good to have looking towards my next chapter, knowing that the richest man in the world is no longer looming over the horizon, ready to buy his way through every political office at every level in America.
Well, that is one of many news items I think we can get to today in this conversation. Let's start there then. Something in the news, Elon Musk and his role in political campaigns. On Tuesday, Musk said in an interview that he was going to spend a lot less in future elections, saying, "I think I've done enough." That was his quote. A report in the New York Times said the race in Wisconsin, where he spent about $25 million backing Brad Schimmel in a losing effort, that the Wisconsin race may have been a turning point and that his public presence in the race backfired. What was your first reaction to seeing that piece of news?
Delight. Delight and relief. And gratitude for the, like, literally hundreds of thousands of people who got involved in supporting Susan Crawford. She had support from 200,000 individual donors, like folks, grassroots donors all across the country, small, medium, and large donors, unions, activists of all kinds, former Republicans, current Republicans who thought that this was completely out of control. We had more volunteer shifts completed in the spring election in 2025 than we did in the midterm elections of 2022, which is something that I never thought of that I would be able to say. And Susan Crawford wound up getting more votes than any Republican candidate for governor in a November election in Wisconsin.
Pretty wild.
It just blows my mind. And that wasn't inevitable. And right. Like it could, you know, the Republican strategy was to try to get more votes than Janet Protasiewicz had gotten because mm-hmm. she had set a new high watermark. Mm-hmm. And they did. They mm-hmm. did turn out more people than any Supreme Court candidate in the history of Wisconsin had ever gotten. It's just that Crawford got so many more than that. So first of all, Elon Musk, you know, chose the wrong state to mess with when he decided to make Wisconsin as the kind of laboratory test case for the new American oligarchy. And then secondly, I think it's hard to remember just how scary that moment was in terms of if Musk had been able to pull this off, it would have sent a message to everyone everywhere that they had to toe the line, do whatever he wanted, or they would be toast. And this was explicitly the threat from Trump to Republican senators, for example, that they had to back his cabinet nominees or Musk would fund a primary challenger. Mm-hmm. People decide whether to run for office in the period after a spring election in Wisconsin. And we were able to show that Musk could be beaten. And that means, you know, there are all these amazing folks who are running for office across the country. And if Musk had stayed involved, you know, it's now clear we know how to make it backfire. And him not being involved means that there won't be potentially, you know, tens of billions of dollars sloshing around the American political system to support the worst, most far-right, completely nihilistic agenda imaginable. And that is a good thing for democracy as well as for Democrats.
Was there a point in the campaign where it became less about Susan Crawford and Brad Schimmel and more about Elon Musk?
I think that it still was about Susan Crawford in the sense that she was this model of integrity fighting back because it was, you know, Musk definitely made this race about himself. He also insisted that Schimmel make it just about Trump. So on one side, our argument was this is, you know, as Susan Crawford said, Elon Schimmel, this is somebody who's right. just going to carry yeah. water for this guy. And then the other side, the final stretch of ads, which I'm convinced, or I my strong supposition is that when Musk gave this last tranche of several million dollars to the Wisconsin GOP that they transferred to Schimmel, and Musk's PAC put out a memo saying that Schimmel's message needed to get Trumpier, and then Schimmel changed all of his ads in the final stretch to just being about Trump's endorsement. Mm-hmm. I think this was Musk calling the shots to say, you need to just talk about Trump all the time. And so, like, Trump was also very unpopular by that point. And so they both kind of made it not about Schimmel, but about, you know, these big hulking Republican looming figures. And Susan Crawford's argument, which was I thought was so brilliant, was to make this about Schimmel's corruption, to make this about the fact that, like, she was this model of integrity, and she was running against somebody who could be bought and sold. She had these ads about instance after instance where Schimmel had been corrupt. And I think that gave voters a reason other than sort of ideology or partisanship to reject Schimmel and support Crawford. But I think without Crawford running the kind of race that she did, I think that you had to have both sides of the pair of scissors to be able to make this work.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, obviously there's going to be a certain dynamic of that in this race when it's happening just like 70 some days after Donald Trump returns to office. Like a certain level of that is going to be inevitably draw some of the focus towards Trump and what's happening. And what was happening, obviously, was Musk and Doge. And that was kind of the dominant story nationally at the time. And it really dovetailed into what was happening in Wisconsin. And you had Elon Musk wearing a cheesehead and giving out million-dollar checks.
Yes. Well, you know, Josephine James tweeted, my culture is not your costume.
Elon Musk. That's exactly a good one. Right. Yes. That's a good one. A good tweet. There are fewer and fewer of those these days.
I know. The last good tweet on X. The other thing is that the Republican strategy was to nationalize the race all along. So Janet Protasiewicz nationalized her race in 2023.
And, right. We were borrowing a strategy that you had deployed successfully.
Yes. And so they decided that's where they were going to go. It just happens that the national kind of conversation at that point was people who were trying to destroy the Social Security Administration and right. defund the Veterans Administration and just take a wrecking ball, a chainsaw, I should say, to things that were sacred to people. And so the idea that that is who Schimmel wanted to line up with, and that's who he thought the court should be doing the bidding of, that was anathema to Wisconsin voters, especially the people who were paying attention, which is the kind of person who votes in a spring election.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of people were paying attention because a lot of people voted.
Yeah. Yeah. And they were terrified. Yes.
So in that election, the one for Wisconsin Supreme Court, that was not the only one this year that you have been heavily involved in. You also ran to be chair of the DNC, the national party, earlier this year.
I did.
You did not win that race.
No, not the same kind of race. Very different electorate.
But what did you learn from that experience?
So the funny thing that just hit me right after the results were called is that an adage that I've had about Wisconsin politics, and that in fact was part of my argument in that race, played itself out in that race too, which is that you can't show up right before an election and expect to earn the trust of voters. You have to build relationships over years. And in that race, I launched my campaign 2 months before election day and was introducing myself to DNC members that I didn't have relationships with. Ken Martin, who's a friend and somebody that I worked with as state party chair, he'd been the chair of the Association of Democratic State Chairs, a vice chair of the DNC for 8 years. So he'd traveled all over the country. He had been, knocking on doors with folks in Oklahoma and North Dakota and all these different places.
This is something that he was probably planning to run for years and years.
The rumors abound about how long he had it in mind. But, whether or not this was his strategy, he was definitely building that framework of trust. And so a lot of, when friends of mine would call DNC members, they would hear, we love Ben, we know Ken. And so it was like, I don't take it personally that they went with someone that they know. And honestly, trust has to be earned in life. I think that it does make a difference for people to know who you are, what you're about. My focus has, I've worked to try to support work in other states, but my focus has been overwhelmingly the state of Wisconsin for the last 6 years. And so for me, my kind of sales pitch was what we've done here, we could do across the country. And that is fine as far as it goes. But if someone hasn't been shoulder to shoulder with me in the trenches with me, then how is it that they would know what it is I would bring to the table? So that's my perspective on the DNC race. I do think that the argument that we were making about how to engage, I think, is the right one. And by the end of the race, Ken Martin and I had very similar kind of proposals around year-round organizing engagement, communicating on every platform, and doing this kind of permanent campaign operation that we've built in Wisconsin.
Bringing the Wisconsin permanent campaign, which to me is exhausting, but to you has been successful.
And exhausting, but also successful. Yeah, I mean, it's just what the moment requires. And the thing is that I think is so often missed in conversations about how the politics play out. Republicans have built a permanent campaign. It's just in the form of for-profit companies. So they have, you know, a vast network of highly partisan right-wing talk radio networks. They have Fox News Channel. They have a massive investment in online platforms and these, you know, huge influencer networks. They've been doing all this work. Leonard Leo, who started the Federalist Society, or led the Federalist Society, he got a $1.6 billion grant to launch an initiative to take the Federalist Society model into winning culture. And, you know, he's funding all this stuff on the right. And so that exists. It's just not in the Republican Party. And for Democrats, essentially, you know, we don't own X. We wind up, we have to raise and spend more money that is official political spending to counter an even larger communication and you know, kind of push apparatus on the Republican side. Mm-hmm. There's a built-in imbalance in the playing field. So it means we have to work harder to get the same results on our side. And that's, you know, I'm not complaining. I don't like it, but it's something I want to change. But it's the way that it is. And recognizing that you can't just launch a campaign. This is not England. You can't have a, you know, 30-day flash election campaign at the end.
Yeah.
Here you have to organize and communicate all the time if you want to earn the trust that can allow you to win elections in the final analysis.
Yeah, we don't have much of an off season for elections in Wisconsin. Like just this week, Chris Taylor announcing that she's going to run for Wisconsin Supreme Court. Josh Shulman just announced that he's going to be running for governor. Like it's a permanent campaign.
It's a permanent campaign.
In the most closely contested 50-50 swing state in the nation. So, but I want to ask you about something that you raised, you know, throughout the course of that DNC chair race. I think it was in an interview on The Daily Show. With Jon Stewart, was talking about challenging the status quo or the establishment and what's normal. And one of the things that you said is that what's normal is not necessarily okay. And I think you kind of insinuated that Democrats need to be doing a better job recognizing this.
Yes.
This is a point I tend to agree with.
This is a core conviction for me. This is not normal, and what's normal is not okay.
So how can Democrats thread the needle then? How can they, in this Trump 2.0 era, both challenge the status quo, challenge the establishment, and uphold some of the basic norms and principles and guardrails of governing that we need in a functioning democracy?
So I think part of it is that the key thing is to constantly come back to voters' lives as opposed to talking about norms and institutions. That the ultimate thing is ensuring that, you know, that folks who are working hard every day can actually come home and live in a house that they, you know, or apartment or the place they want to live. They can afford to keep a roof overhead. They can buy medicine. They can let their kids join a sports team, even though they have to buy the uniforms. Like the basic aspirations of working people across Wisconsin, across the country, you just have to keep that in the center of the frame. And when Republicans attack, you know, 100 different things, and each of them is incredibly important, you should fight to defend them. But they're not necessarily the center of the message that you want to communicate. And in fact, essentially, if you're fighting to defend democracy, but democracy is – people feel like democracy is not working for them, mm-hmm. then it feels like you're not fighting for them. And in 2022, I used to say, to save democracy, talk about roads. Fix the damn roads. That's right. Yeah, Governor Evers ran on fixing the damn roads. And in fact, has been the bulwark. His veto pen has been one of the most important collections of atoms in the world in the defense of democracy in this state. But the reason why folks support him is that they really feel like, you know, he cares about what's going on in their communities. I reposted a post by him this morning about how he's actually out filling potholes. And that constantly bringing it back to things that people can touch and see and feel and that are real, I think is critical. And then you have to have the policies to back it up. You actually have to deliver. There was a debate in the Democratic kind of, you know, online ecosystem about the idea of deliverism, that you win support by actually delivering on things. But it turns out that if you pass a law and it doesn't actually turn into a thing that happens, then the deliverism kind of falls apart because people, you know, like the famous kind of Tennessee Valley Authority Rural Electrification Program, the people who voted for FDR and they voted for Democrats for decades because FDR turned the lights on, that depends not just on passing the federal legislation. It depends on people's lights actually turning on.
Yeah.
And that's, so you have to run, you know, all the way through. It's a much, much harder thing to do than it is to break government and then run against government, which is the Republican strategy. But my core belief is like there are people for lots of different reasons have come to see how sacred, how incredibly precious and fragile democracy can be. And we need to get everyone who shares that conviction together. And then all together, we need to recognize that when we go out and talk to voters who feel like the system's already broken, who feel that that democracy is rigged, that clearly is not making a difference in their lives, we're not trying to convince them that the system's actually fine.
Right.
We're showing them that we're going to use this system to actually fight to make the kind of difference that they need in their lives. And if we can do that, that is how we can earn people's trust. And then we can kind of deliver those changes together so that people remember who was on their side when things went wrong.
Yeah, I feel like there's almost a divide in the Democratic Party. There's a variety of divides in the Democratic Party, ideological, whatever.
You don't say.
But yeah, I know. Three Democrats, five opinions, right?
Yes. But
I think there's almost this divide between action and inaction that I see in the Democratic Party right now. Is just like that deliverism thing like you talked about. I think there were so many things that the Biden administration passed that oftentimes I agreed with very much, but like, it's going to the process of it getting to actually you seeing it in people's lives takes forever.
It takes so long. Trump is currently touting things that happened under Biden. There are 11 car plants being built in the United States. He was like talking about how incredible this is. All those were announced by President Biden, thanks to Biden initiatives. The initiative to make sure folks can get access to federally funded federal research is now coming into reality. This was a huge push by the Biden administration that they did, and it's now actually moving forward. It's in some ways the nobility of politics is it's like in George Washington. Was it George Washington or was it Hamilton making up words for George Washington, but planting seeds of trees whose shade you'll never see?
I know the quote. I don't know who said it. Yes.
It's a beautiful, great thing. But in sort of practical political terms, you gotta get that tree up fast. Because if people aren't feeling the shade, they're not going to know who planted it. And it's not going to have a political consequence for anyone, except maybe your successor. It's sort of like Trump with the Obama economy that he was so proud of, which was like a straight line continuation of Obama until Trump presided over a massive crash.
Right. And then, and I guess at the same time, it's just, and this was a point made by Green Bay Mayor Eric Genrich in the Recombobulation Area in a piece he wrote for us a couple months ago about just like how long it would take like to fix a bridge in their town.
Yeah.
Right? And just like how long these things take. And I think, there was we started to see it towards the end of Biden's presidency around Milwaukee, those billboards or signs up around, street construction say, hey, brought to you by the bipartisan infrastructure law. That didn't really start happening until 3 years after it passed and stuff like that,
it's
too.
True.
So it's just
true.
Like it takes a while to get things moving the way they should. I think that's one of the things I think the Democratic Party needs to do more in the years ahead is just focus on action and results and not getting bogged down in ideology.
I just completely agree, emphatically agree. And there are precedents for this. There are often wartime mobilizations, but sometimes they're not. I mean, the COVID mobilization was incredibly fast.
Right.
And there are also instances, state by state by state, where some piece of infrastructure goes wrong and the state moves quickly and effectively and is able to address it. It's just that, if that can happen as exceptions to the rule, why are we not changing the rules to make that the rule? Let's really dig into this. And there's all kinds of,
If we can prop up a safety net during COVID, we can do it any other time, too.
Right. This is the thing. For so long, it was easy to be cynical about nothing can ever change. How can we ever make progress? Our political system's broken. Then COVID hit, and we mobilized trillions of dollars. And then, between COVID and then the Biden administration, we did cut child poverty in half.
Right.
Then we just decided to let it go back up. And when I say we, almost every Democrat was like, let's keep not having, millions of children going to bed hungry. Like, let's just not do that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, not quite enough.
Not quite enough. Yeah. And that to me, it is so jarring how much change was possible in what a rapid space of time when we just decided to do it. And that, I think that is the kind of footing that we need to get on for so many things that drive people so furious in their everyday lives. It doesn't have to be this way. We can create that change. We just did it. We just have to get it together to keep doing that. And I think if we can do that, we're in an era of just profound instability politically. The amount of the presidency changing hands, of Congress changing hands in both chambers.
Yeah.
There's only a couple times in American history that have had this kind of ping pong back and forth.
Right.
And that happens when there's the sense that this isn't working. So swing voters essentially are like, maybe they can fix it. Nope. Maybe they can fix it. Nope. Maybe they can fix it. Nope. And I think if we want to have enduring majorities for Democrats or just for clean, effective, you know, honest government, what we need to do is fix it. We need to make genuine big change that people can see and feel in their lives. And people will be like, yep, this is what I want. And I don't want to elect the people who are saying we should go backwards.
Yep. And now we're going to see some of that now that the Biden administration implemented during the second Trump term, which is something.
It's something. At the same time, Trump is already so mangling so much that I think that I don't think we're going to be in a world where just Trump is coasting on Biden's accomplishments. He is actively, he has grabbed Elon Musk's chainsaw and he's using it to attack the global economy. So for worse, but I think there's going to be plenty for Democrats to run on other than saying, actually, Trump is taking credit for Democratic accomplishments. We can point out how he has made things worse in people's lives and how we'll change that.
Yeah. Well, we could talk about national news all day here, but let's talk about something a little bit closer to home. So in this race to be your successor, I guess, in the race for WISDEM's chair, which, as I mentioned, less than a month away now at the state party convention in Wisconsin Dells in June. I'll be there, looking forward to it. But you made an endorsement in that race for WISDEM's chair. You endorsed Devin Remiker, who has been part of the state party for quite some time, was part of the Harris Walls campaign in Wisconsin last year. Why did you endorse Devin Remiker?
So we're a few weeks out from the convention, about 3 weeks and change right now. And as it drew closer, watching the race, we've got three great candidates. It just struck me that I know Devin will be a great chair. I have worked hand in glove with him. Some of what drove me to run for chair in the first place was stuff that Devin had helped to build and run at the party. I have seen him look around corners. I've seen him he built the campaign, Defend Justice, to stop the impeachment of Janet Protasiewicz. He built the People versus Musk campaign plan, worked with the Crawford campaign, worked with the party, our allies and partners, and put us on offense. And I feel like it would be a disservice to this party that I have invested so much of my own life and work and that I believe in so dearly, and to the state, if I didn't just share what I know, I know the other candidates. I don't know them nearly as well. I've seen firsthand that Devin is standout, extraordinary leader in this work. And what we've built is at the state party is something that I'm really proud of and is very unusual. It is unlike any other state party in the country. And Devin, uniquely in the race, he not only has helped build it, he knows exactly how it functions. He knows what the challenges to overcome are. He's really good at de-escalating conflict and finding win-win solutions. One of the things that I'm most proud of at WISDEMS is that we're the only state in the country where for two presidential elections, the presidential campaign has come along and it has said, your organizing operation here in your state, this will be our field campaign in your state. In every other state, they set up a separate coordinated campaign. Mm. This is not to say there aren't tensions and disagreements where the headquarters says, knock on this door, not that door, and folks on the ground are like, wish we could, actually there aren't some Democrats in that town or whatever. But the fundamental thing of not just yanking the tablecloth off and resetting the table and then having that whole apparatus collapse the second the campaign is over and then having to start from scratch. In a few other states, there are year-round organizing programs that operate on the side, but there's still a presidential that comes in and then disappears. Mm-hmm. But here we have one continuous program with our county parties and with our neighborhood teams all across the state. Mm-hmm. And that both has taken, fundraising. It's taken the dedication of tons and tons of volunteers. It's also taken extremely nuanced and careful political work to build the buy-in from every candidate at every level, from the national party, from our allies and partners. And Devin has really led and driven that work. And if we want to keep Wisconsin, the Wisconsin model of year-round permanent campaign going, I just know that Devin can carry that forward. And he can also take it to new heights. He has a bunch of ideas that we have not been able to put into effect that he's talking about on the campaign that I think are great. So I don't want to end the election and be like, why didn't I just say what I knew? Mm. And, I decided to come out and post it online. And, everyone has their vote. This is an election. There are delegates to the state convention. But I do think, everyone who has, information and ideas and opinions should say them. That's how democracies work. Mm-hmm. And I certainly have a point of view myself.
Yeah. Okay. But I will ask, you said at the outset that you were going to remain neutral in this race. What changed?
I changed my mind. I think fundamentally, when I said it at the outset, there were a whole bunch of candidates, there were a whole bunch of different people running, people were in, people were out. I didn't know where it was going to land. And I didn't feel like I knew then you know, how I was going to feel. So I, you know, if I could go back, would I say I made decide to endorse later? Yes. Yeah. I definitely wish that I'd done that and I didn't anticipate it. My, you know, I've talked to, you know, former chairs in various places, some of whom said at the outset that they weren't going to endorse and then regretted it by the end that they hadn't said something. And like, I just didn't want to be that person. I felt like, you know, the only time when you can affect an election is before the election. And I definitely didn't want to not be transparent. I didn't want to like be, you know, advocating for someone while saying I was neutral. So either I was going to stick to being neutral and then, you know, not have actually, you know, shown up and shared what I knew, or I'd have to change my mind. And that's what I wound up doing.
So you just wanted to, I guess, be on the record in a certain sense of just saying like, hey, this is what I actually believe. And I'm just going to come forward and say it instead of, I get, you know, because this is kind of the approach that the Democratic Party takes, like when there's a primary or something like that, too. Right. So like we're not going to endorse in a primary and so and wait to support whichever candidate the voters choose from that primary. Right. Is there a different dynamic with this versus that type of thing?
I think it's very different because in this case, the parties do endorse candidates all the time in races. Yeah. You know what I mean? And in this case, like the election is run. We have an elections commission chosen by the whole administrative committee. The staff, I've really impressed on the staff. I'm doing this in my personal capacity. Their job is to support all the candidates equally. They all have the, you know, the same information, the same tools. And like when people are running for office, they try to get the former and current office holders to endorse them. And you know, like that is, it's just a, I think it's a lot of how these things play out. And people are, you know, people ask me a lot about who I've supported. And I have like been really careful to not, to like, you know, not saying that just wound up feeling weird. I also think that the, one of the dynamics is, you know, Devin as a candidate has been running and talking about his experience, the work he's done at the party, but it's not clear to voters in the race, like, how much role did Devin actually play, given that I was chair? And I don't want to be like carrying around credit for stuff that Devin actually drove as the executive director. He's my longest serving executive director at the party. A lot of times if you're running and you worked with someone, you kind of carry all the baggage of things people didn't like, but get none of the credit for things that people did. And I, like, I you know, I don't like that dynamic either. So I feel like it's, I feel like it's the right thing to be able to talk about specific things that, that Devin drove. And there are so many of them in a way that might not sound credible otherwise. I think for the other candidates, it's very clear. No one thinks that I was the power behind the scenes at Zepeki Communications or in the third congressional district, you know, congressional district party. And, you know, Joan William have done, you know, lots of great stuff that they talk about. But for Devin, I think that there's always going to be a question for folks of like, how much is this stuff that Devin's talking about came from Ben or came from Devin? And the answer is Devin has done vastly more than he's ever gotten public credit for. And he's, you know, running for chair. And I think if he's in that position, people are going to be able to see the kind of offense that he mounts, the kind of relentlessness, the mission focus, like all these qualities that I've, that have made me trust Devin and look to him to take on major, major roles at every step of my time as chair.
So what you're looking for here is to quote one of my favorite campaign lines from the HBO show Veep, continuity with change. Is that the is that what you're going for here? The continuity with change?
That's really funny. I think the specific thing, one of the specific things that I think Devin really brings is this constant commitment to innovation. And so I want to continue the innovation, which I guess is a version of that. But yes. Yeah. And I think, you know, I do think if you think that the Democratic Party of Wisconsin is so fundamentally broken that it needs to be burned down and something else needs to be built in its place, Devin's probably not your candidate. If you think that this is a party that has like broken records and done extraordinary things and you want someone who's been intimately involved in doing that and can take things to the next level, then I would argue Devin is your candidate.
So let's talk a little bit about the actual mechanics of the race.
Yes.
This chair race will feature ranked choice voting utilized for the first time. How do you think that that might impact the race? And what are your thoughts on ranked choice voting more broadly?
I think it's fascinating. I think it's been like great for democracy in places like Maine and Alaska, where you've seen that play out electorally. One of the good things about ranked choice voting is that it encourages a level of civility, because if someone is not your supporter, you still have an incentive to try to earn their, you know, their second place support. One of the poisonous dynamics in American politics is that on the Republican side, the strategy is generally turn out our base voters, try to persuade some other voters, and then suppress everybody else. But with ranked choice voting, you don't want to suppress everybody else. You want to you know, bring them over. And I'm proud to say this is not the practice among Democrats. But I would rather have a system where everyone is incentivized to not be so far out of bounds that a huge group of voters is, trying to drive you out of politics altogether. In this race, so when I was running for chair, there was ranked choice voting. This was a policy that was pioneered by my predecessor, Martha Lanning, who also launched our year-round organizing program, which inspired me to run for chair myself. Ranked choice voting was in place in, I think, a couple of the congressional district elections that when I was running for chair, and there were three candidates for a while, and then one dropped out. So it wound up just being two. But I think in this race, it means that for everyone who's running for chair, they have an incentive to talk to everyone else, every delegate. And I think that has the positive impact of meaning that everyone gets the benefit of everyone's ideas, that there's an argument that every candidate can make to everybody else. The downside is it's more complicated. And so I think for people wrapping their mind around what it means that, someone might be absolutely supporting another candidate, but that you're still getting asked for your second place vote or what have you. And then when the votes are tallied, there's going to be like a little, if no one wins with more than 50% of people's first choice, there'll be an explanatory process to lay out how it all means. We'll find out how it plays out, but I have enormous confidence in the team, and it's all paper ballots, and it's going to be very kind of transparent process in terms of how the process is conducted. And for folks listening who are not deeply involved in the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, which how could that possibly be the case? Wisconsin, unlike a lot of states, we have a pretty broadly participatory system for choosing chairs, vice chairs, treasurer, secretary, the statewide party offices, also our DNC members. So today is the 21st, we're recording this. Anyone until the 24th of May can ask their county chair to make them a delegate to the state convention. Mm. That's at 5 p.m. on the 24th. That's when the delegate list closes. There are, as of the last
count, right in the middle of the holiday weekend, right?
is what it is.
Yeah.
The last count, there were like more than 1,000 people had signed up to be delegates. So, so there's a question of how many of the delegates actually show up for the convention,
but
there's a bunch of routes to it. At this point, the route is through your county chair. When I was elected there, I think there were 1,200 voters, and they come to the state party convention June 14th to 15th in the Wisconsin Dells. It is a water park, so it's a great opportunity over Father's Day weekend to bring your kids to a place with a lot of water slides. And then there's, you have to be a member of the Democratic Party by the end of this month, paid up member. And one of the reforms instituted under my chairship is that it's pay what you can. So you could pay $25. We have a veterans and students and seniors rate of $10. Or if all that is too much, you could pay $1 and become a party member. And then you come to convention and you cast your vote, and you've just chosen the head of the, I would argue, mightiest state party in the country. And it's pretty cool. I think for all the sense that people who are a couple steps further from politics have that parties are an insider operation and it's actually strikingly open door that people can get involved. They can make change. There've been lots of highly contested chairs races all the way down to county levels. Like, if you want to make change at the party, you can get involved and advocate for and make that change.
Mm-hmm. A few other things I want to get to. We're going to get to them a little bit more quickly given the time here. So Joe Zepecki is among those running for state party chair. He's picked up a number of endorsements. And in his first statement about the race, he said something in the press release I really found interesting. He said, and I'll quote here, every conversation I've had about the future of our party gets back to the same place. Democrats have got to do better when it comes to how we communicate our message. We need more effective communicators, period. What's your response to that statement?
Emphatic agreement. I think we need more communicators, period. I also think there's a distinction between how I feel about the kind of national kind of blob of like, what is Democrats versus how I feel about how we do here in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
I've not heard anyone say that our messaging was off in the spring Supreme Court election. Like that was a purely Wisconsin driven operation. Cassie Finelli, extraordinary campaign manager, and Susan Crawford and the party and our allies. We drove a message that was crystal clear and it totally resonated. It worked. Everyone knew the messages.
Right. Right.
And we won really big.
It's like how people say they hate Congress, but like their congressperson or something
exactly.
Like that.
I will say that lots of other states and lots of other places across the country, you hear from people that they also don't like how it's going where they are. I feel like we've pretty good record here. Like, I think it's pretty strong. And there are definitely exceptions to that and times when people are frustrated. But I think that there's a lot of strength to build on here. I do not think this is a dismantle it and put something else back together. I think this is building additional muscles where we need them. And there's lots of those places. We can always get better. But I do think that there's a lot that folks across the country honestly can learn from the way that Wisconsin Democrats communicate, which is very much to bring it to the lives of voters, to go to where the voters are, not to hector them or judge them or try to, you know, make them feel like they were wrong and they need to do better. Fundamentally, it's about recognizing that no matter your politics, that all of us need a good, you know, school for our kids and roads that we can actually drive on and a job, ideally a well-paid union job, and then prices that we can actually afford so we can get by. And then our personal freedoms and rights, you know, respected by the government, not trampled. Those are things that are incredibly broadly supported views. And they're the messages that Democrats convey over and over, that we, you know, we want the state to work for everybody, not just for a handful of people at the top. And usually when people are complaining about Democrats' messaging, they're complaining that Democrats talk about other stuff all the time. And I don't think you have to, you know, abandon your values in order to bring the conversation back to things that the vast majority of Wisconsinites agree with and the Republicans are trying to actively dismantle. So I do think that the fact that so many people feel like Democrats are communicating bad things suggests that there's clearly a problem, right? And if you look at national polling, the disapproval for the national party, even Democrats, voters in Wisconsin, approval for the national party is at an all-time low right now. But that is not to say that the stuff that we're doing is the wrong stuff. I think that there's a, you know, I think if people take exception with the way that we've poured our energy into communicating here, I'd love to hear it because we want to get as good as possible. But I think there's a lot to build on, a lot of strength to build on. And to me, a lot of the work is the last piece of what Joe communicated. We need more great communicators to be in more places at more times, because when people hear what Democrats are fundamentally about, the idea that we should be a country that works for working families, that everyone's their personal freedom and dignity should be respected, that is stuff that most people want to give a big thumbs up to. Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's part of that communications issue that is also a credibility issue? You know, obviously the book about Joe Biden's health has been in the news. I don't want to talk about the book, but I want to talk about like the credibility aspect, because I think that in a lot of ways, in my opinion, really damaged the credibility of the Democratic Party. Do you think that steps need to be taken with regards to Biden's decline in office, his health, what have you, as a credibility question?
Here's what I'd say. Right now, there's a federal budget debate over whether to execute the biggest transfer of money from the poor to the rich. And I need to fact check this, but I saw it online today, in the history of federal policy. This is trillions of dollars that would be cut from Medicaid, from healthcare for working families and for families of modest means, and then transferred in the form of massive tax cuts for the ultra wealthy. When you ask people what they don't like about Democrats, the biggest thing fundamentally is the feeling of like Democrats aren't fighting for me, and people don't see Democrats fighting for them. And the way that we change that is by making crystal clear, like in the biggest, loudest, most effective ways that we can, that we are against cutting taxes for the rich paid for by everybody else, that we are for making sure everyone can see a doctor when they get sick, that everyone can join a union and have a job that actually supports their family, that we are for making this economy not rigged for those at the top, but instead supporting everyone so that people who are, you know, working hard, people who have aspirations of building their own business, that they can actually make that happen. And that fight, the more we are pouring ourselves into that fight, that to me, that is how we rebuild support for Democrats. And there's a million things that you could go back and you could say that you want to change. But the fundamental thing that people evaluate candidates and parties on really is, how will this affect my life? And that's where Democrats need to make it unignorable that both Republicans are trying to make their lives worse and the Democrats are going to fight to make their lives better, and that when they get the power to do it, they actually will.
So the thing about Joe Biden's health is that Republicans are taking away your health care and taking away and redistributing funds to the wealthiest in the nation?
Let me put it this way. When you go to 2024's election, do you think that it would have made a bigger difference if Kamala Harris had publicly attacked Joe Biden, or do you think it would have made a bigger difference if Kamala Harris had more deeply convinced people that she was going to fight for their economic well-being in a way, and that Donald Trump was going to hurt it?
I think of those two options, the latter, but I do also think she needed to distance herself from Joe Biden.
Yeah, I think that would have I think that absolutely would have helped. But if I had to choose one, I would do the second one. And yeah, she had 107 days, and like, every time you open your mouth in public when you're a presidential candidate, you're choosing between everything you could talk about. So when you look at the analyses after the election, We lost the most among the people who said they were most affected by inflation and prices. If you look at polls of young people, you look at polls of people who didn't vote and then voted for Trump, people who voted for Biden and then voted for Trump in 2024, the economic, that fundamental economic divide was by far the biggest thing.
Yeah.
Vastly bigger than everything else. And the whole Trump campaign message was essentially, you know, the infamous anti-trans ad that Kamala Harris cares about mm-hmm. they, them, Trump cares about you. That was both an anti-trans ad, but it was also an economic ad saying that she wanted to spend your money on something other than your economic well-being.
Right.
And the cutting through that by landing vividly on the fact that Trump was trying to rip money away from regular folks and give it to his, you know, multi-billionaire buddies is something that can change the valence of the election. And I think the really critical question of like, how do we break through with that message? How do we make sure that message is seen by people who are tuning out of TV and, you know, aren't connected to politics in general? How do we build the credibility to show that we're not just saying this, we actually mean it? I think that that is often through actions, not through words. And so much of communication fundamentally, it is not, you know, it's visuals as well as language, but even beyond that, it is being seen doing things and taking action that is unmistakable. And sometimes it means pissing off the right people, which I think Elon Musk is a good example of the right person to piss off. That to me is the central thing for how Democrats rebuild trust. Mm-hmm. I think Trump has demonstrated to us over and over and over that there's a lot of norms, there's a lot of process stuff that can make, you know, people, you know, in the Brookings Institution freak out. But for voters who would rather never think about politics, the stuff that's actually going to affect their lives and their kids is the thing that swings them the most. And I think that's where Democrats need to put their biggest thinking caps on about how do you, not thinking caps, action gloves. they put on their Carhartts and actually get out there and get to work.
Okay. Another question about, you know, just what the next WIS Dems chair could focus on. So from my perspective in the media, one thing I always take note of is when there are people working on campaigns, particularly in the communication side, who are not from Wisconsin.
Yes.
You can always tell. You can always tell when somebody's not from Wisconsin and they're working on a campaign. It's oftentimes somebody from the coast who comes here to be part of a campaign and then we'll move on when the ballots are counted. And it's not that someone here is doing a bad job necessarily, but sometimes it's people who maybe don't get Wisconsin the way I think people from here do. So as in that role as party chair, to what extent, you know, obviously to a certain extent, you're going to want to hire the best people, right?
Yes.
But to what extent do you have to navigate the finding the right balance between bringing in talented people from outside the state and hiring people and developing talent here in Wisconsin?
So the way that you square the circle is through talent development over time. It's through literal training programs. It's through having lots of internships and paying your interns. It's through working to make sure that folks are, you know, placed and are able to find jobs and next jobs. Inevitably, you know, there's some amount of shrinking down campaign staff after like a presidential race and then expanding again for the next race, but making sure that folks are able to stay in the state and find ways to do it. It's also making the jobs sustainable. So paying a competitive salary, we actually pay for health insurance at the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. We have a 401k match, stuff that, you know, does not exist in a lot of different places. And that allows you to make this a long-term, you know, path for people to pursue. And over time, our staff has become more Wisconsin-y. When I came in, you know, I did hire more folks who were from other places and had a lot of amazing experience and did a ton of stuff to contribute and build our operation. If you look now, it is mostly, is it entirely? It's overwhelmingly, maybe entirely folks that are either, you know, grew up here and now work here, have spent their whole lives here or have worked here for multiple cycles and have very, very deep connections and understanding about Wisconsin. And that's something that I'm really proud of. And it kind of takes that work and that long-term view because, well, we have a new finance director at our state party. She's from Wisconsin. She then worked across the country. She was John Tester's finance director in his Senate race, one of the most expensive Senate races in the country. And then she just came home and mm-hmm. you know, she's joined our team, which I'm thrilled about. And that, you want to be a place where people, a destination where people want to work, where it's not just a kind of way station to check the box and go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And you want to have fresh ideas and fresh blood. And so I do think that there's a value to you know, to balancing, combining both of those things. Sometimes when there's a pool of potential folks, there's a lot of history that, you know, may be helpful and maybe not for particular candidates, especially folks in state, but that's also true for folks not from Wisconsin. Cause often, you know, if someone's applying from somewhere else, there's a reason why they're not working in that place. But I think having a really serious attitude towards finding amazing people and intimate knowledge of Wisconsin and belief in Wisconsin is one of the core things that makes you effective at the job, I think is really critical. Mm-hmm. And often in campaigns, they scale up so quickly and then disband so quickly that there's not actually a lot of careful vetting and quality control. Wisconsin political operatives in our campaigns, I mean, people like Cassie Finelli, who ran Susan Crawford's campaign and Tony Evers' campaign, senior advisor to the Wisconsin Party now, we have people who have made long-term tenures, who have deep relationships, who have intimate knowledge of this work. And that allows us to both kind of hire, attract, retain amazing folks who do really world-class work at an institution that in kind of normal American politics is not the kind of place that the most extraordinary operatives want to spend their time in. State parties, in most states, it's 5 or fewer staff. Mm. In Wisconsin, we haven't had less than 50 staff since I staffed up in the fall of 2019. And it means that there's actually capacity to do stuff. It's not just plans on a shelf somewhere. We're actually going out and making change and making a difference in the state. We don't get everything right, but we keep learning from everything we get wrong and try to get better and better. And to me, that's the goal. And that's what I want to see continue at the party.
Okay. We've got to wrap up here, but I got one more question for you. What's next for you? I had several people tell me they thought that at some point you might be interested in running for statewide office, whether that's governor 2026, Senate 2028, something beyond that. What's on your mind?
Well, we have a great governor, and I hope that he's running because I have every confidence that he'll win.
You want him to run again?
I think Tony Evers has been extraordinarily effective. And the other thing is he has had in every budget a set of things that I dearly want to be in Wisconsin policy that Republicans have ripped out of the budget and thrown to the side. And so the idea of winning a trifecta in 2026 and actually passing these things into law is something that I relish with every fiber of my being. I could imagine running for office one day. At the moment, I'm working on a book proposal to try to write down some of the ideas we've talked about the things that the country can learn from how we do politics here. And things that I think we need to do to fight, and especially for folks that are trying to figure out how they can be part of all this. So much of my time is spent thinking about if we have this precious resource of people's time or maybe a few bucks that someone can donate, how can we stretch that to the absolute limit? And I want to try to get that out into the world in a different way. So that's my next project and spending some time with my kids. I'm chaperoning a field trip tomorrow
for my
son Jack's elementary school. And that is the kind of thing that I've had to say no to for 6 long years. So I'm excited to say yes.
Well, take some time to recombobulate and spend some time with your family. Ben Wickler, always enjoy the conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.